Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. We are glad to have you here with us. Now, you may not realize this because of the year that 2020 and 2021 have both been, but it is September. I know, it's a wild ride, and it's hard to believe it. I feel like it was January yesterday, January 2020 yesterday, but it is in fact September. And let me assure you, we have reached the fall, and I've got a few pieces of evidence. Number one, tonight is the first of the NFL season. I don't know if any of you are football fans out there, but I'm excited being a Dallas native. You know, my Cowboys are on tonight, and I know that everybody's been gearing up for the season. I bet you got your fantasy lineup all set. Another thing that we know, it's the fall because tonight's high, or tonight's low actually, is not in the 90s. So that feels like a pretty big deal. The other thing that's perhaps a little less well known that marks September is Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. Now, that's right, as of 2020, September was declared by Congress and President Donald Trump to be Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. I read the declaration myself today, and I've decided that I would like to get into a position where I can declare months to be themed. I think that sounds like a real neat power. But 2020, we decided September was Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. And so tonight, we're going to be talking about sickle cell disease. I've got two incredible physicians from LSU Ochsner here to talk with me about it tonight. First, I have Dr. Purnim Ramadas. She is a clinical assistant professor at the Feistweiler Cancer Center, and she is a hematologist-oncologist at the LSU Health Center. She did both her residency and her fellowship in New York at the State University of New York in Syracuse. So, Dr. Ramadas, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us, I have Dr. Richard Mansour, who is a professor of medicine and the program director of the hematology-oncology fellowship at LSU Health. And he is also did his residency at Ochsner in New Orleans, so a good Louisiana boy. And then finished up with his fellowship in hematology-oncology in San Francisco at the military hospital at the time. You said so it was the VA, but it's not the VA?
Yeah, it was an active Army base that has since been closed because it was on such a beautiful spot right over the San Francisco Bay.
Ah, I got you. You know, and San Francisco real estate is at an all-time premium, I think. Well, welcome. I'm so glad to have you all here tonight. Now, first of all, I'm sorry, I need to invite you in the community. If you are listening and you would like to join us here on Red River Radio talking about sickle cell disease tonight, we are at 1-800-552-8502. Feel free to call in with any questions you might have, maybe personal experience with sickle cell disease. We're just kind of anything you want to contribute to the show. We're happy to have you. Again, that number is 1-800-552-8502. Now, first and foremost, from our guests, I would sort of like a description of what is a hematologist. What is your area of expertise? How do you get to be a hematologist? Maybe start with that first. Tell me, how do you get to be a hematologist? Because I think that from the outside looking in, the medical community is very opaque and very foreign. And so a lot of people say, oh, you're a hematologist. I don't have any idea what that means. So first of all, what does it take to become a hematologist?
So hematologists are doctors who treat blood-related disorders. So initially, after you finish your medical school, you go through 3 years of internal medicine residency. And after that, if hematology is what you want to do, you do additional training called the fellowship. And a lot of programs for fellowship, it's hematology combined with oncology, which is basically blood and cancers together.
Okay.
So that's additional 3 years of fellowship. And
Man.
Then you become a hematologist.
So you, too, are a fan of school. What is that?
College, yes. 4 years. Medical school, 4 years. Internal medicine residency, 3 years. Hematology oncology, 3 years. That's 14 years after high school.
Goodness.
In the US.
So by that point, you're like really excited to just get out and not be a student any longer, huh?
Yes.
Although now you are actually working in the program, so now you're torturing other poor residents and fellows as they come up through it.
Yes, it's very enjoyable.
All right, well now, so tell me about this. So we're talking about, you know, it's not a spoiler, I guess, but we're talking about sickle cell disease because this is Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Month. So before we get into that, though, because this is, you know, clearly your blood doctors, I don't feel like that's giving anything away too much. But give me the basics about, like, what is blood? Because we know that sickle cell disease is a disease of the blood. But I feel like, again, and this is a very basic question. I feel like this is maybe for some in their cars just rolled their eyes. Like, what is blood? But there's a lot of people who probably don't know that there's a fair bit of complexity to it. So can you give me kind of a basis of, like, what is in blood? Because sickle cell disease is clearly not a disease of all those things. It's just part of it. But okay. Give me a little overview.
Okay. So obviously, if you watch any shows on television, you'll know that if the blood comes out, you don't live.
This is true.
It's an essential part of the body for life, but it's composed of salt water, proteins, and little blood cells which carry oxygen from the lungs to the muscles of the brain, the kidneys, and then get rid of waste that's breathed out in the lungs. So it's a very important substance and completely necessary for life.
So what is, then I guess explain to me a little bit, what's the difference between hemoglobin and a red blood cell? Because again, these are words that are thrown about on a like Law and Order. You're gonna hear this word eventually if you watch it long enough. But what is there a distinction there? Like, what is hemoglobin?
So basically, red blood cells are the cells which carry oxygen in the blood. And hemoglobin is a substance which is an iron-rich compound that's a part of a red blood cell.
Okay.
So hemoglobin is a part of a red blood cell.
Okay. So hemoglobin is part of a red blood cell. Now that we have this basic understanding, myself and the audience who was before confused, or maybe not, maybe you were more educated than I was on that. Oh, yes, Dr. Mansour.
Yeah, you might think of a blood cell as a sac that is filled with hemoglobin.
Okay, all right. Because, so now, knowing this, that red blood cells, small little bags full of hemoglobin moving around your body at high speeds, what is sickle cell disease?
Okay, well, when those little red blood cells are moving around the body at high speeds, that hemoglobin inside has to stay very in a liquid, so it's very flexible because it has to squeeze through small openings. So if you're trying to squeeze through a fence, you know, a red blood cell has to squeeze through small blood vessels, and if the hemoglobin doesn't stay liquid, it can't do that. So when hemoglobin has the sickle cell disorder, it at certain times it loses its fluidity and it becomes a solid, and the blood cells can no longer squeeze through small blood vessels, so the blood vessels can be blocked up, and that causes a lot of problems.
Okay. So, yeah.
So basically, normally the red blood cells are these very nice, round-looking cells,
yeah,
which can easily go through the blood vessels, as Dr. Mansour talked about. So with sickle cell, with that problem with that hemoglobin,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes the cells become shaped like a sickle.
Okay.
So you know, it's basically like a sickle or a crescent moon shape.
Okay.
So that's how the term comes. Because we can, when we look at these cells, we can find that particular shape.
Okay, so it is a very aptly named, which is unusual. I feel that nothing in medicine is appropriately named. So it's nice that there's one thing. It is called sickle cell disease because literally, the cells, your red blood cells specifically, become sickle shaped and then get caught in small blood vessels. Where are these small blood vessels? Where are they getting caught?
Everywhere.
Throughout your body.
The whole body. Because you have to, the blood cells go through very small vessels to deliver oxygen and pick up carbon dioxide. And that's what they go to the lung, get the oxygen, go to the tissues, drop it off, pick up the carbon dioxide, go back to the lung, and you exhale that.
Okay. So what are some of the problems associated with that, I guess? That sounds bad. I can't really imagine. What would that cause? What does that lead to?
So normally in somebody, your blood flows very well to all these different organs. So what happens with sickle cell disease is because of these blockages in these small blood vessels,
mm-hmm.
it pretty much cuts off the blood supply to these organs to a certain extent. And that cutting off blood supply can happen more so dramatically and also kind of chronically over a long period of time. So literally every single different organ can be affected by that because all your organs are dependent on blood supply.
Okay.
So, you can have problems with your brain, like strokes when you have blood vessels clotting off in the brain.
Okay, yeah.
You can have problems with the eye, similar reason.
Okay.
You can have problems with your bones, which is actually one of the most problematic thing for patients with sickle cell disease.
Really?
Because when you cut off the blood supply to the bones, they get dead. Similarly, every single organ can be affected. Lungs are another organ which can be affected. So it can pretty much affect most of the organs in the body.
Oh, wow. Okay. So now you commented specifically on bones having trouble. So having dead bits of bone sounds bad, but I mean, what is the, does that just lead to a lot of like fractures, or does that lead to actual like decay, or what does that lead to?
That leads to severe, dramatic pain episodes, and we call those sickle cell disease crises.
Okay.
Because the inside of the bone marrow gets, basically the tissue dies, and that's extremely painful. It's like having a broken bone, and it can happen spontaneously. Mm. It can happen in multiple bone areas at one time, and it's frequently precipitated by cold weather.
Why is that? That's unusual.
Well, the theory is that when you're cold, the blood vessels constrict, and that slows down the blood flow, and the slowing down the blood flow entices the sickling crisis.
I see.
So
okay. So now that leads to sort of a natural follow-up. Does that mean that places like Colorado, does that mean that places like Canada are particularly troublesome for people with sickle cell disease?
It's known to be more troublesome in patients who are in like colder climates.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is that one of the recommended things, is like move somewhere that's warmer? I mean, do you go so far as to suggest moving? Because told you have to move to like Cancun as part of your treatment is not a bad option.
Well, you know, the cold weather is very problematic for patients with sickle cell disease. The patients will tell you they never had the opportunity to go swimming as children because they would be thrown into severe total body pain.
Really?
But the question about Colorado is different because Colorado has high altitudes and there's less oxygen at high altitude, and a low oxygen environment will also precipitate severe pain crises and other catastrophes for patients with sickle cell disease.
What about the low oxygen environment? Because the cold makes sense to me. So if you have something that has trouble squeezing through the fence boards, I like that analogy. I think I can at least wrap my head around that. So if you have something that has trouble squeezing through the fence boards, I get why if you bring the fence boards closer together, that's going to cause troubles. But what about low oxygen causes problems?
So low oxygen has been known to also increase the sickling process, what we talked about.
Okay.
When the sickle cells actually get all these small clumps inside all these blood vessels. So in addition to the cold weather, low oxygen causes all these sickle cells to kind of clump up together.
Okay.
And basically, it's not just the cold weather and oxygen. The other things which can do that is extreme dehydration.
Okay.
When you get really dehydrated, when you're out in the warm weather and not really drinking much fluids and things like that, or if you exercise quite a bit, all that is also known to cause the same process, kind of making those sickle cells stick together.
Okay. So, I mean, it's kind of, you're kind of in trouble both ways, I suppose, then. Now, does that mean, I guess the question that flows out of that from this is, you being two hematologists in this area, do we have a larger percentage of sickle cell patients in this area just based on climate alone? Is it that most people tend to not live in the north or tend to live in, you know, lower altitude environments?
Well, you know, it's really more that the Shreveport area has a larger percentage of people who genetically heritage from Africa, and the sickle cell trait is one that's very high in Africa. It's a complex talk, but it's a lot about malaria. So it's the percentage of African ancestral patients that we have here in Louisiana that lead to a high incidence of sickle cell disease. because you have to inherit, it's a genetically inherited disorder.
Okay.
And you have to inherit a gene from both parents to get the disease. So.
Well, no, that's actually, you said it's a complex topic, but I love complex topics. Hmm. So that's a very interesting point. You've at least piqued my interest. So malaria? How is malaria involved? Because as you said, I mean, this is much more common in the African-American community. One out of every 13 African-Americans is estimated to carry the sickle cell gene, not to be a sickle cell disease patient, but is estimated to carry the gene. And I mean, that's a huge population compared to the rest. I mean, the next closest is the Hispanic population, which is thought to be 1 in 100. But I mean, tenfold more common in the African-American community. And you kind of hinted as to why that might be. But can you expound on that a little bit?
Okay.
Uh-huh. I mean, try to.
So, you know, this is hard to imagine, you know, growing up in the U.S., but there are about 500,000 children who die under the age of 5 in Africa from malaria every year.
Oof.
And if you have the one gene, the sickle cell trait, you're 10 times more likely to survive childhood malaria. So
really?
That means that there's a natural tendency to build up children who can survive malaria.
Sure.
That increases the number of people with the trait. And in some parts of Africa, it's 25 or 28% have trait.
Good gracious.
And
now,
so,
can you explain that to me a little bit? Why is the trait protective? I know this is getting deep.
So
now,
it's a little bit complex. So malaria is actually a parasite which affects your red blood cells.
Okay. Which we now know what those are, thanks to our earlier talk.
It sits inside your red blood cells. And that's one of the primary areas where malarial parasites survive.
Okay.
So part of the thought process is with the condition that happens with the red blood cells, mm-hmm. in patients with sickle cell trait, those parasites cannot really do all the things that they normally do in somebody who have healthy red blood cells.
Is the sickle cell disease equally protective? More protective? I mean,
no.
No.
No, the sickle cell disease is, they can't, it's very difficult to survive malaria with the disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
the
so it's specifically selective.
Bad. Yeah.
That's very interesting. Because, I mean, otherwise you would wonder, how would such a trait, if it was so problematic, become such a large percent of the population? But it is, in fact, somewhat protective, depending on where you live.
It's because malaria is such a problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, does that also explain people with Hispanic heritage? Is that because malaria is a problem in Central America, or is that completely unrelated?
Well, it's actually all related, but you know, at the top of Africa sits the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay,
and
true.
All the countries around it, you know, at some time in the past, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands, in many cases thousands of years ago, there was malaria very heavy in all that area. Mm-hmm. And so there were many blood disorders that came up as a protective against malaria, where if you get one gene, you're protected. If you get two, you have a fatal illness.
I see. So now that'll probably get into something that we were going to talk about a little bit later, but the Sickle Cell Disease Awareness Association, the SCDAA, which needs to work on their name just a touch, but they have put out some fact sheets about this, and they mentioned on one of their fact sheets, and I thought, they just blew by some big terms here, but they were talking about the genetic inheritance patterns. And, you know, as you say, you have sickle cell trait versus sickle cell disease. And they commented that you need two copies of the sickle cell trait to have sickle cell disease, with a few noteworthy exceptions. And they listed those as, quote, for any of you who've gone out to the Sickle Cell Disease Awareness website, HBC, HBE, and beta thalassemia can be the exception to that rule. But I read those and I thought, okay, these are words I saw in med school, but it's been a minute, and they didn't bother to explain it at all. They just kind of threw it out there like, yeah, you might have this thing too. What is that?
It's a little bit complex to explain in simple terms, but, you know, I'll
try. I believe in you. I believe you can do it.
So basically, in sickle cell, the sickle cell disease versus sickle cell trait.
Okay.
So sickle cell disease is a condition where you have two copies of the gene, and sickle cell trait is the condition where you have a single copy of the mm-hmm. gene. So when we talk about two parents, if one of them has one copy of the gene and the other one has just one copy of the gene, when they have kids, there's all these different possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So usually around 50% of the kids can just have a sickle cell trait when they just get just one copy of the gene.
Right.
25% of the kids will have both copies of the gene.
Yeah, sure.
So they'll have sickle cell disease. And then another 25% may not have any copy of the gene.
Sure.
So they'll have a normal hemoglobin.
Okay. Straight Mendelian genetics, right?
Yes.
Right.
When we are talking about other complex sickle cell syndromes, that's what we call it, basically, you can have one copy of the sickle cell gene, and there are these other, what we call mutations or problems with your hemoglobin that are that causes other diseases, which is called thalassemia, HBE, or HBC.
Okay.
Some of them are kind of a similar way of how it happens. Basically, you have a problem with one of the you have a problem with hemoglobin.
Sure.
So it's a different problem with the hemoglobin in HBC and HBE disease.
Okay.
So sometimes patients can have a combination where you have part sickle cell gene and part one of these other genes, which is HBE or HBC.
Sure.
And depending on what partner they have, that changes how the sickle cell behaves.
Okay.
And more than the HBE thing, one of the common things we see is thalassemia. So thalassemia is also a problem with the hemoglobin.
Sure.
So you can have sickle cell with thalassemia together.
Okay, so they're basically, these are like the exceptions to the rule. Like, you only have one copy of the S, so you should be okay, unless you also have one of these other exceptions.
Yeah. I might also add that all of those other exceptions are also a consequence of children having an advantage to survive malaria.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So it all comes back to malaria.
Yeah. Now, in this region, we're in Louisiana, we see the C... because we see the sea, because the people who were brought here were from the region of Africa that had the sea.
Okay.
With the S. And we also see a disorder known as thalassemia with the S. We do not see the E. That's primarily in Southeast Asia, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Burma.
Okay, so now is the disease of HBC with sickle cell, is that a similar appearance or is it completely different, like it's its own animal?
So they are similar in a lot of ways, and they are different in some ways. Overall, it's known that HBSC disease or HBS with C disease may be a little bit less severe than when you have two copies of, you know, HBS or the sickle cell. But it's not always like that necessarily. A lot of times they can still develop the same complications that somebody with the two copies of sickle cell disease, this gene has.
Okay. So we've talked about this. So it's clearly, I mean, first of all, I think it's fascinating that something that is theoretically negative is also protective against something that's more negative. It's like the lesser of two evils situation. But are there any other like ethnic groups, or do you see this at all in the Caucasian population? Do you see this at all in any other populations, or is it primarily just these groups?
Well, the hemoglobin S mutation exists in all populations, but the frequency where the chance of getting a child with two defective genes is low enough to where you would rarely see it, but it's definitely possible. So if you look at the world map of the hemoglobin S gene, you see a pretty good sized population in Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And there's some regions of India that have a pretty good sized population. So there are other populations, but again, it's all due to hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of years of malaria.
Yeah. So now I think you've answered this question, but something worth noting, is this at all contagious?
No.
No.
No. No, because it's genetic, right? I mean, you have to inherit it. You have it from birth. Now, how quickly is it diagnosed normally? I mean, how do you know if, you, like, what if people listening are thinking, I wonder if my kid has this?
If you have parents that have, like, known sickle cell trait or disease, newborns are screened.
Okay.
But usually most of the problems with the disease, depending on what kind of sickle cell disease they have, it's usually after around 6 months or so of life.
So you know pretty quick. Now, is this something that people should be getting screened for? So if you're in one of these at-risk populations, let's say you're African-American and you don't know your sickle status because maybe mom and dad don't have sickle cells, so you've never thought about it, is it worth getting screened? And I mean, what's the value of getting screened? Does it prevent it? Can you prevent anything? Can you do anything about it if you've just got trait?
Well, we're not pediatricians, but I think actually there is general screening program. I know some states it's mandated.
Okay.
Because it doesn't usually present till 3 to 6 months after birth, and it can present with a fatal syndrome.
Oh, my gosh.
So
so better to get it tested. Yeah.
But I want to say, just volunteer a few facts. Okay?
Please do.
Because when I started medical school, it was 1973.
Mm.
And sickle cell disease was pretty much a pure pediatric illness. It wasn't really part of adult medicine. And then great strides were made in treating children with sickle cell disease. Now, they still suffer terribly, but the majority of them survive to adulthood, whereas, you know, in 1950 or 60, very few kids survive to adulthood.
Sure.
So now, but the kids have years and years and years of bone damage and liver damage and kidney damage and heart damage, and sometimes they suddenly lose vision. And it's permanent, or they have a high incidence of strokes. A very high incidence, 40% of children have some kind of stroke with sickle cell disease with the SS type. So, you know, it wasn't an adult illness. So we're adult hematologists, and we don't have a pediatric hematologist sitting with us. And, you know, they see the syndrome in younger patients. They see all the same problems, but the patients look a little different because you know, I don't want to be derogatory, but if you compare a new car to a 20-year-old car, it's a lot easier to break a 20-year-old car.
Sure.
So we're dealing with people who have suffered for years. And, you know, the problems we see, I don't think it's appreciated how severe this disease is and how these people suffer.
I mean, one of the biggest problems in the community is, like, pain medication not even functioning anymore because they've had so much from so many painful crises that it barely works for them. I mean, I feel like I've seen that personally. Do you see that? I mean, and that's got to be a problem, especially as they get older and they've been given so many different pain medications to deal with crises that things don't even affect them.
So I think everybody is different. It's not the same thing with every patient.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of depends, going back to the severity of sickle cell disease. And one of the other things is, even patients with HBSS disease, not one single person is like different from the other, because not all of them have all the same bone, you know, bone problems and things like that. And some of them, so every single person have something like works for them with regards to the pain regime.
Mm-hmm.
There's a small group of patients, as you mentioned, who have a lot more severe problems with regards to bone disease and other things. For them, you know, there are like times or over years, they can have the amount of pain medications that they need can slowly increase.
Right.
But
just
it's not the case
tolerance.
Every single person.
Yeah, we have to use large amounts of pain medicine. There's a problem today with prescribing pain medicine because there's been a chill put into the medical community about confusing the problems of drug abuse on, you know, out in the community with illicit drugs or a few apparently a few providers that are overactive with drugs in diseases that are not sickle cell disease and not cancer. So it, the ability to get adequate pain medicine is becoming more and more difficult. The pharmacies are being restricted. Some of the large pharmacies have been sued for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for dispensing with doctors' prescriptions.
Okay.
And but, you know, our attitude at LSU is we know that sickle cell disease is exempted in a specialty clinic from the CDC guidelines
okay.
on maximum pain medicine.
Okay, so there is at least some provision being made there.
Right. And you know, we basically prescribe to the need. And when patients get into a crisis who have been on large doses of chronic pain medicine, well, we just give them enough to take care of their pain.
I mean, and it's an admirable thing, and it's tough to do. And I know that I'm sure you've faced additional scrutiny, especially in recent years. I know there's been a huge crackdown on opioid prescriptions, and at some point, it is the best tool for the job. But right. You know, you understand why there's been a crackdown. Now, we actually have a caller here with us. We have got Benjamin from Shreveport who is calling, and you are on Health Matters. How can we help you today?
Hey there. Thank you for the program today. I've been listening since the beginning. I know you guys have just started touching on some of the treatments, including the pain medication. But, you know, I work at LifeShare Blood Center, and I know that, blood is one of the main ways that people with sickle cell are treated throughout their lives. And I was hearing Dr. Mansour earlier, you know, talk about, you know, the struggles that these people have throughout out their lives and, you know, how incredibly, you know, painful and debilitating the disease could be. And since blood is one of the chief tools that we have to treat this ailment, I was going to see if the doctors would mind talking about that a little bit more. And then, you know, talking about how, you know, people who are listening who, you know, obviously that's a great way to help and give back to the community. And, you know, just maybe some encouragement there. And then maybe their experience when they're trying to treat patients and that product isn't available.
We'd love to talk about it. Benjamin, thank you so much for the call. We really appreciate it. So, I mean, do you want to speak to that a little bit? So blood products being used as a treatment and then, you know, the need for it or if there's been shortages or, you know, kind of that situation.
Yeah. Depending on the severity of the sickle cell anemia, the hemoglobin may be very low or it may be normal. And depending on what the hemoglobin is and depending on some of the complications that patients with sickle cell disease have, mm-hmm. There is a role for regular blood transfusions where we bring up their hemoglobin levels to a certain degree,
okay,
so that essentially we can dilute out the sickle cells,
okay,
so that there is more of normal red blood cells in circulation. And the thought is when we dilute out those sickle cells, the disease manifestations or the clumping and all mm-hmm. that happens decreases. There's also another thing that we do, and that happens more so in acute situations where patients are really very sick.
I was going to ask that. Is that a prophylactic or is that a therapeutic typically?
So usually a lot of times it's, so it can be both, okay, depending on what you're trying to treat. So prophylactic, which means preventative, is basically in people who have had a complication in the past, and one of the common reasons is people who have had a stroke in the past, that we want to keep their sickle cells lower than a certain degree mm-hmm. so that the chance of them having a repeated stroke is reduced. Therapeutic means treatment-wise is usually a lot of times those patients are in the hospital. They are very sick. They can have a new acute stroke, or they can have one of the common other reasons is something called acute chest, which basically means a really bad sickle cell disease manifestation that involves the lung, where your oxygen really drops down. So in those situations, what we do is take out a whole bunch of units or bags of red blood cells mm-hmm. and give them normal red blood cells to try to bring down the sickle cells to a very low level so that they can recover from their acute illness.
Okay. So a little bit of both.
Yeah. I'd like to make a point on that in terms of blood donation. So in our adult clinic, but in children, the primary treatment for stroke prevention is transfusion. So they're not the same size as adults, but they have a lot of patients, and there's a lot of blood needed. I don't know, maybe 50 units a month. We have 55 patients on chronic transfusion therapy who have graduated pediatric clinic, and they come to us with a history of stroke and a couple of other severe problems. Mm-hmm. So ideally, we would give each one of those patients 2 units every month. So that's over 100 units in our clinic. And then the people come in the hospital and need a blood exchange 2 or 3 times a month. So there's another 25. So we need about 175 units.
Holy mackerel.
Per month, just for the stuff we do at our place. So I want to just make the same appeal. That blood cannot be manufactured other than by humans.
Right.
So we need since COVID, we've had a big blood shortage, and we've had to reduce the amount that we are giving to below what we would like. It's a big need for more blood in this community.
How many units can you donate in a sitting? Is that dependent on the person, or is it like a, everybody gives 2 kind of thing?
On your hemoglobin.
I was just going to do some back of the napkin
math. Most people give 1, but I think there's some giant humans where they take
sure,
a super
sure.
bad.
But I mean, I guess my point being there that you think if you need 175 units a month, that requires 175 different donations every month, which just, again, impresses upon you that there needs to be a relatively big, as far as number of people involved, community effort to try to donate. And that doesn't count anything that happens in surgery. That doesn't count anything that happens in the trauma bay. Like, clearly this is just for, sickle cell care.
Right. Because, we treat other blood disorders. We also go through that much blood a month in our leukemia unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the trauma center downstairs, they use hundreds of units every month. So the more people who can donate, the better, because there's no other way to get blood and through donations.
Okay. Well, and where's a place that somebody can go to donate? I mean, we had a caller just talk about it, but where's a good place to go to donate if we had someone who was interested?
Well, the LifeShare.
Where's that?
Where?
I can Google it if you don't know.
Google it. I'm not a native Shreveporter.
Well, that's a good thing to know. LifeShare is actually on Linwood Avenue.
Yeah,
so if you're
right,
interested in it, they would take you. Is it open 7 days a week? Probably. But that's a good place to go. Give them a call if you're looking to donate, if you're looking to make a difference in this capacity.
And they have blood drives, and maybe someone would like to call in and tell where these blood drives are usually held.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be good to know. So we would love to hear from anybody at the LifeShare Center who could tell us a little bit about maybe a blood drive.
Yeah, we even do that in the hospital sometimes. Like, they have like blood donation drives. Actually, we just had one yesterday. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, and you get a free t-shirt, right?
Yes.
Okay, come on, it's totally worth it. All right, now, we're having a serious conversation, and I'm always good to have serious conversations, but I like to interject a little bit of humor into these conversations just for a brief break from the serious. Life's too short to be serious all the time. So today, we're going to have a little bit of trivia. Now, tonight's trivia, because you are blood doctors, we are going to talk about the OG blood doctors, which would be vampires, of course. So tonight we're going to have some trivia about vampires to see if you know anything about your true roots.
All right.
All right. Now, our first question.
I probably would.
Who is everyone's favorite vampire? That's not the question. The answer is clearly Edward Cullen.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, there you go. All right. I pegged you for a Twilight fan. Now, I know you were probably, Dr. Mansour, I feel like you were thinking Dracula.
Yes,
am I wrong?
I was thinking Dracula.
I don't know if that was, I was just typecasting you, but yes, Dracula, but she's thinking Edward Cullen, and she's right. It is Edward. I am Team Edward for sure. Now, here is a little bit of Twilight trivia, or, the modern take on the vampire. I'm going to give you 4 options. 3 of them are correct, and 1 of them I made up. So you're going to have to pick which one of these, A, B, C, or D, is the lie.
About a fictional character?
About a, well, it's the actually, movie. It's about a movie.
Oh, the movie.
The movie, yeah. Twilight. It's technically a book.
Oh.
But either way, these are facts regarding the movie. They are not facts of the fictional characters. Okay. We're going to get to fictional facts in a minute.
You have to answer this.
Fictional facts.
Yes.
All right, so the whole of Twilight, A, the whole of Twilight was filmed in only 17 days, and they didn't do any reshoots, partially because they assumed their primary audience was teenagers who would not notice filming inconsistencies. B. 50 Shades of Grey was originally posted as Twilight fanfiction on the website fanfiction.net by the user Snow Queen's Ice Dragon. So 50 Shades of Grey was inspired by fanfiction surrounding Twilight. Number C. Twilight was the most purchased DVD of 2009. And E. No, excuse me. D. Boy, I'm having a rough time over here. I'm having a small issue. D. The vampires of Twilight famously avoid sunlight, but not because they'll die, but in fact because they sparkle. So three of these are true. One of these is false.
Now, it's probably A or B.
Okay, so I'm going to say one of these is fake. So you're Dr. Mansoor, you're saying that false is that 50 Shades of Grey was inspired by Twilight fanfiction.
No. That's something you can't make up.
No, D is D, right. I know that. I know C and D is right.
I'm so glad you're a Twilight fan.
See, Twilight just came on Netflix.
Oh, there we go. A Netflix plug. We are not sponsored by Netflix, but if you're interested in Twilight, apparently it's out there. Okay, so we've ruled out D. We've ruled out C. You think it was, in fact, the most purchased DVD of 2009, and they do sparkle. So that leaves us with either A, the whole thing was shot in only 17 days because they weren't worried about inconsistency second to their teenage audience, or B, 50 Shades of Grey is, in fact, inspired by Twilight.
Go ahead.
I don't know.
Oh, you got to give me an answer.
Pick one.
Maybe, I don't know, B is wrong?
No! Oh my goodness, this is one of my favorite trivia facts of all time. 50 Shades of Grey is in fact Twilight fan fiction that was rewritten without vampires, yes. Which explains, I feel like, a whole lot. But no, they filmed Twilight in 46 days, which is apparently pretty close to industry standards. But I thought it was a fun fact. All right, now you know, right?
Well,
I know.
I don't understand. Why didn't you pick the television show about vampires that was filmed here in Shreveport, right out in the southern...
Wait, which was that?
There was a whole year of a series.
That's like New
Orleans. For 2 years.
Oh, was that...
There's something in New Orleans.
I don't watch anything with vampires in it.
And it went on for about a year or two.
Oh, man. Well, I'm sorry. I have another trivia question, but we'll save it for later.
And, Vampire Diaries.
Well, we've actually got Benjamin back on the line who has information, I believe. So, Benjamin, you've got info for us. We'd like to have it. Uh-oh. Benjamin, have we lost you?
Vampire got him.
Ah, the vampires again. All right. Well, Benjamin, call back in if you'd like to give us some information on when and where people can donate to LifeShare. Now, is there anything else people can be doing? This is something I saw was kind of interesting. So the Sickle Cell Disease Association released a facts and stats sheet from 2020. And they were talking about, they rated the United States on different metrics. Access to care, training for physicians, how we're doing in the world. They rated us on a couple things, and they gave us, on an access to care scale, 1 to 10, they gave us a 5.7, which they said was an increase from previous ratings, which they had estimated at 5.6, and then in 2016 they said we were at a 3.7. So they're saying access to care is improving, but they're still saying it's not great. So you as physicians and you who provide care for patients like this, what is something that we as a community can do to help provide increased access to care? Is there anything we can do? Is there something that you would say could be improved upon?
You know, it's a tough question, but...
Yeah, fix the problems of the world. That's what I'm asking you for.
Sickle cell disease causes poverty, particularly in the adults, because it's hard for people to work and keep their job when they're having these crises.
Sure.
So they're an impoverished population. Many adults went without any insurance until the Medicaid expansion. And so that, you know, LSU was a place where patients could come. But the extreme poverty associated with sickle cell disease in impeded having insurance, which impedes access to care. I mean, that's the only way I can put it.
Okay. So now, is there anything we can do to, I mean, I don't know, is there anything I can do? Is there anything people listening can do if this is something that really calls to them?
Yeah, well, the sickle cell fundraisers, which is usually put out by Sickle Cell Society.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to blood donation.
Well, blood donation, but I think as a whole, the society as a whole has to begin to look at this disease as a disease that affects everyone, not just a certain group. And the society needs to, raise more money for research in the disease, because there is research, but, you know, relatively speaking, relative to other diseases, I think it's been under-supported, this research.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some, phenomenal treatments that are being studied, but they're not being studied quickly enough, but there's some things that are happening that with probably more research, they could be sped up and change the entire complexion of this illness in the United States.
Yeah, with 100,000 people being affected. So, I mean, not like a small group of people being affected here. Now, I've got Benjamin back on the line. Benjamin, we're going to try one last time. Benjamin, tell us.
Hey, sorry. I was just going to let you all know you all had it right. Live share, we're there at Linwood Avenue. We also have one in Bossier on Doctors Drive.
Okay, when are you all open?
8 to 3 on Friday. We're also open on Saturday. I also, in the break there, talked to the folks from Flying Heart, and anybody who donates tomorrow and says they heard it on Health Matters is going to get a free pint for pint from them. So, you know,
hey,
that's a great time to respond to this.
You know, and they say that you get drunk a lot faster if you drink after donating blood. I don't know if there's any truth to that, but...
Well, we have to tell people not to drink for 2 hours.
Okay.
But we are not the beer police.
Okay, so where do people... Tell me again, one more time. Where do people have to donate if they want to get a free pint from Flying Heart?
Yeah, 8910 Linwood Avenue or Doctors Drive in Bossier tomorrow from 8 to 3, and of course we've got all the mobile drives as well, liveshare.org. We have at least two or three out somewhere in the Arquitex every day.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for calling back with the information, and a big thanks to Flying Heart for being willing to donate and support a cause like this. We really appreciate that. Now, we've actually got some other callers here. We have Jerry from Shreveport calling. Jerry, you are on Health Matters.
Hi. I was just going to say, when I was younger, I used to be a navigator on a 141, and we had to go at a lower altitude because of sickle cell, and also I just remember that, but I thought it was really interesting since before that I was
We've got a pretty bad connection with you, Jerry. I think the point that he was making is just that it's interesting that you do have to stay at a lower altitude, because I think you're worried, you know, as he was talking about with the oxygen, as we discussed earlier.
But commercial aircraft are okay.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask that. Are commercial aircraft okay?
Yeah, because they're pressurized.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Jerry, thank you for calling in. I'm sorry we had a bad connection about that. So tell me a little bit about, we're getting towards the end of our time together. And I know there have been some strides made in treating this in the last couple of years. Now, I saw a couple places where the Academy wanted everybody to know that there is two new drugs that have been approved for this in the last couple of years. But what are those drugs? What do they do? They didn't name them. So I just know that there's drugs. Yay. But I know nothing about them. So can you tell me about them?
So, yes, that's pretty exciting after decades of just having hydroxyurea.
Okay.
Which was the age-old drug which has been approved for sickle cell disease. So we have two new drugs. One is called Oxybreta, that's the brand name, or Voxelotor. And what that does is it actually affects the how the sickle cells kind of stick together. It's known to increase the hemoglobin levels when patients get started on that drug. And that's a pill form of therapy. And it's very well tolerated. And we do have patients on the drug that we have seen their hemoglobin go up by 2 points or higher.
That's awesome. So, I mean, that's a big breakthrough then. Mm-hmm. Especially anything that you can do that would reduce the amount of actual blood you have to use. Does this allow you to reduce the amount of units you need to transfuse?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because I know, I mean, as you stated, that's a hugely limited resource. Mm-hmm. Unless you go to LifeShare tomorrow on Linwood or in Bossier between 9 and 3 and get your free pint from Flying Heart. But That does allow you to use fewer transfusions?
Yes.
Well, that's awesome.
And it may also improve some of their symptoms. So the second drug, it's this drug called Adakveo or crizanlizumab. Basically, that drug is an antibody drug which is given through the IV. And what that helps with is some of these crises. The whole mechanism of how crisis happens, that's one of the drugs which affect that mechanism. So the patients who have been treated with that drug are known to have lesser of those painful or pain crises and lesser hospital stays. And that's also a pretty well-tolerated infusion, but it's just like an IV infusion versus the other one is a pill.
Wow, okay. But I mean, still, big breakthroughs there.
Yeah, it's only every 4 weeks infusion.
Yep.
That's improvement. I also saw that there was some stuff coming down the pipe. They listed, what did they say, that there was a potential, like, one or two new studies that people were going to be able to enroll in coming up pretty quick, like human trial kind of stuff? Are you aware of anything coming up with that?
Well, we have a couple of trials with Adakveo with other indications in sickle cell disease. And but there are some...
They specifically they said the NIH is reporting that genetic-based curative therapies could be available in could be available in clinical trials soon. Well, but that, to me, sounds like kind of fake news. So no, tell me about that.
They are available in clinical trials.
Really?
Yep.
So you have to start with the basics. I mean, you can actually cure sickle cell disease if you get a bone marrow transplant from an identically matched brother or sister.
Okay.
The way we talk matching, it's... is a specific type of matching. But most patients don't have an identical match brother or sister.
Sure.
And so the next thing that's being studied, and it is in trials, and is that you take the blood and you spin it around and you get out something called the stem cells. They're like plant seeds for blood. And then you take those and you treat them, and you actually fix something in the genetics, which changes the type of hemoglobin that they make. And then you give it back to the patient. Now, that's what's in clinical trials. And there are several different approaches. There's probably four different approaches. One has been in clinical trials for 2 or 3 years, and is probably going for FDA approval very soon. And then the others are in human trials. Well, some are in human trials, and they've been advertised in the news, some of the results. And then some are still in before human trials. But this area of science and genetic manipulation of human blood seed cells is moving very fast.
Okay, so real potential there.
Yes.
That's excellent. Now we have another caller. We've got Evelyn from Alexandria. You are on Health Matters.
Hey, you can hear me?
Yeah, we hear you. Welcome to Health Matters.
Thank you. I'm calling to let y'all know I'm one of the callers that got sickle cell.
Oh, well, we're glad to have you on.
Yeah, and I go to Fishwater Cancer Center, and they deal with sickle cell patients there. And I've been going there for about, like, maybe, I don't know how long, probably about, like, 6 years now.
Okay.
I love going over there to their doctor's place. They do really good. They're really good.
Well, I'm glad to hear that they've been able to help you. Are you feel like you've been stable? Do you feel like things are going well? I mean...
I've been doing stable. I've been pretty good.
Now, tell us, this is a good way to get a plug for our a blood drive. How have you had to have transfusions before? How many transfusions have you had to have?
I had to do a lot of blood transfusion.
Yeah. So just a big part of your treatment?
Yes. I do it now once a month.
Okay.
Over there at the Fishwater place. And, I do that like every month, if not twice a month.
Okay. Well, Evelyn, we really appreciate you calling in. We're glad that you're getting good care there. I'm really glad you didn't call in and say you can't stand it up there, because I've got two of the doctors from Feinsweiler on with me, and that would have been incredibly awkward for me for the rest of the show. So I'm so grateful that they've taken excellent care of you. And it's good to hear that you're A, doing well, and B, that there is this need for these blood products, especially while we're waiting for these additional therapies to become approved or to be perfected or to become more effective. So, Evelyn, thank you so much for calling in with your experience. We appreciate that. And again, I'll just use that as a plug. Apparently there's a blood drive going on right now. Tomorrow at LifeShare, if you go donate blood tomorrow, either in Bossier or in Shreveport, you will get a token or a ticket for a free pint, a pint for a pint from Flying Heart. So, it's cool to see local organizations, Flying Heart being a local brew pub, that get involved in this. So we're really excited to see that. Thanks again for calling, Evelyn. But as we're kind of wrapping up here, guys, I just want to ask, what is something you would like the audience to take away from this? What is something that you would say, this is awareness month, so we're aware, but what would you like us to take away?
Well, I think, awareness of the disease as an important human disease that needs solutions, and compassion for the people that have it. Because, these people suffer from childhood. They usually have a shortened life, and sometimes they don't have all the understanding that they should have from all of us.
And I think in the community, even among doctors and other healthcare providers, there's a lot of bias with the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Especially going back to the fact that you mentioned about pain control, unless you are the person suffering from pain, it's hard to really know what these people are suffering from.
Right.
So, I think that inherent bias that a lot of people have, that needs to slowly change, and hopefully as more people know that sickle cell disease can be a very severe disease and all these patients have a lot of issues,
mm-hmm.
and they suffer from the disease, hopefully that will help lessen that bias a little bit.
Certainly. And there was another thing that, and maybe you can speak to this, but I would talk to any, particularly any healthcare providers out there. There's an initiative called STAMP. Are you familiar with STAMP? It's a treatment. It's training for providers, basically. It's encouraging. It's a 6-month series of free web-based trainings, 2 sessions a month, that are off. Basically they were given out, and I think you can still access them. And they are for preventative services, and they are basically education material for people who are in primary care, because they, their concept is that a lot of primary care physicians don't necessarily understand sickle cell as well as they ought to, and therefore people who have sickle cell receive not bad treatment, but not maybe optimized treatment, just because they're not aware of what the common standard of practice are. So people who aren't very severe, who don't end up at a hematologist's office all the time, maybe are getting missed or glossed over, and some things that could be done better are being missed. And so there is a web-based training opportunity called STAMP that is out there for any primary care providers or just physicians in general who are interested in learning more about the treatment of sickle cell disease. So I feel like that's probably wrapping us up for tonight, but I just want to say thank you so much to y'all for coming out with this. I know that this has been a great talk. I've enjoyed it. I've learned a lot, personally.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Oh, we're so glad. And again, I'll give our final plug. We've talked about the need for blood. We've talked about the importance of that. 175 units a month in just the sickle cell clinic, and it takes about one person per unit. I mean, again, there may be some giants out there who can give too, but if it's a person per unit, we need at least 175 people donating every single month for just the sickle cell unit. That doesn't include leukemia, that doesn't include trauma, that doesn't include surgery.
That's just the adult sickle cell unit.
It's just the adult sickle cell unit. So, I mean, there's a huge need for blood. We have a shortage. This is a great time to go out and donate. So tomorrow, I would encourage you, go donate tomorrow, get a free pint, and if you don't even drink, you don't have to get a pint, but you can still go donate. It doesn't stop you. So thanks, guys, so much for coming. I just want to close this out by saying this program is for informational purposes only. For all health issues, please consult your physician or healthcare provider. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Thanks to Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Snell for providing phone assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff. This program It will be available for podcast online at redriverradio.org. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Patrick Laveau. Thank you again for being part of the audience, and tune in next Thursday for more Health Matters.